Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated. This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Paul Hunter Popler versus Hugh F. Banasek from Dallas County. Apex Towing Company and others versus William M. Poland III and others from Jefferson County. And Quantum Chemical Corporation versus Ralph Tinney from Harris County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. And we will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. These arguments are being recorded by the court, and you may purchase an audio tape for a nominal fee from our clerk. The court is ready to hear oral arguments from petitioners in Hunter Popler versus Banasek.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Patchell will present argument for the petitioners. Petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is a legal malpractice case. The principal issue to be argued this morning is one of limitations. Summary judgment was granted in the trial court on numerous grounds. That summary judgment was reversed by the Court of Appeals on all grounds. The reversal on the summary judgment was based primarily on the tolling rule in Haney and Higgins as modified by Merton. This morning, I'm going to argue principally that this case does not fit within the specifics of the Mahaney and Higgins tolling rule. And it also does not fit the policy values and judgments that underlie that.
Shouldn't the rule, Mr. Hatchell, though, out of the Hughes case be an absolute bright line rule? Wouldn't that make it easier, particularly since we're dealing with limitations?
Your Honor, I've done enough of these to know that I don't know that there are any bright line rules. And I think what I'm going to hope I can show you this morning, that this case simply has got enough facets to it that it is outside of any bright line. But one thing I am going to suggest, if I have time, is that Mahaney and Higgins be overruled and that a new rule be substituted.
Would we have to overrule that case?
Not to sustain our position
in this
case.
And why not?
You do not, and that's why that would be my principal argument, because I know the court would be reluctant to do that. If there is a basis on which to sustain my position under the rule as written.
Well, why would you not have to overrule it? I have a hard time understanding that.
Because as I said, but let's just get to that point.
I'd also like you to explain when you're done with that why we should overrule it.
And I'll be glad to do that. Your Honor, there are three basic underlying policies for the tolling rule. One is that the client is forced into inconsistent positions. Number two, the client would be forced to obtain new counsel. And number three, that the outcome of the malpractice case is dependent upon the underlying case. There are three facts only that you need to notice in this case to understand why none of those three indicia are met in this case. Fact number one. The underlying litigation commenced in June of 1991. And all these facts, by the way, occur more than 2 years before the malpractice case was filed. In June of 1991, the underlying litigation commenced but was terminated in trial. At that point, Mr. Banasek states that he had lost confidence in Mr. Undercroft entirely, that he knew something was, quote, drastically wrong. Fact number two. By November of 1991, Mr. Banasek was describing Mr. Undercoffer's conduct, his handling of the litigation, his preparation for the case, his understanding of documents, and his actual performance in the courtroom as, quote, extreme negligence. He also said...
Well, you're arguing the discovery part. Why under the tolling provision would there be a difference?
No, I'm not arguing the discovery part, Your Honor, because at this point, he also said, Mr. Banasek said, that Mr. under copperhead stated, I am not going to be your attorney anymore.
Well, what if he had sued? What damages could he have recovered at that point in time?
Oh, he is complaining loudly about his expenditure of funds, and he has not gotten his value.
Well, that's only part of the damages.
Well, that's right, Your Honor.
So you're going to have a part trial now and a part trial later?
Well, but Your Honor, the rule has always been that you do not have to await. In order for accrual to occur, you do not have to wait to full completion of the damages. Abatement more than adequately takes care of that situation.
Well, there are multiple problems with abatement. Besides the seeming absurdity of filing a lawsuit merely to hurry up and wait, there is another potential problem looming down the road, and that is what we've seen in some other states and what we're feeling pressure in this state, and that is with regard to ensuring the courts are customer-friendly and are performing the way the state wants them to perform. What if the legislature comes out with a rule that says all cases filed in a trial court must be tried or dismissed within 12 or 18 months? If we have a file and abate program, we're either going to have either A, all these cases are going to have to be dismissed and people are going to lose their cause of action, or B, we're going to be sitting back here in 5 years revisiting the rule, coming up with another rule because of what the legislature is
doing. I do not subscribe to the notion that filing the lawsuit is a bad thing. Bear in mind that the limitation...
What do you gain by just filing a lawsuit and putting on total abatement? You gain a singular thing, and that is you got a lawsuit filed. There's the only distinction between filing a lawsuit and going to abatement and tolling the limitations is the fact that you got a lawsuit filed.
No, you gain much more than that, Your Honor. I've done enough of these things to know, and this case is a perfect example of this. The tolling rule encourages the parties to stay together and try to work it out. If the tolling rule didn't exist, the parties would at least be required to act and confront their problems sooner. Bear in mind that the tolling rule deals with the situation that occurs only after an accrual, and you are a very long way down the road once you have accrual under both the legal injury rule and the discovery rule. You have the parties, particularly in view of SP versus Harvey and Childs versus Hosecker, you have a very heightened, in my judgment, discovery rule, in which the parties know malpractice has been both discovered and that it is most likely due to the wrong of the attorney. I don't think that from a policy standpoint it's a bad thing to require the parties to put the cards on the table early, because I think that there's sometimes, and I've been involved in enough of these to know, that the intervention of a third party, which would be engendered by getting the process going sooner.
I'll tell you one bad thing about requiring the parties to put their cards on the table early is something that I think is more important than any of the three things that you mentioned, which were policy reasons behind Hughes. And that is, I think it's critically important that the party who wants to assert the legal malpractice not have to disclose any of its attorney-client privileged information. They shouldn't have to disclose whether they're pleading, and certainly not through discovery, anything that they claim that the lawyer did wrong, and then have the lawyer come back and say, well, no, this is what I did right, and this is why I did what I did, and therefore disclose to the other parties involved in the ongoing underlying litigation privileged information. And I think that it seriously compromises that situation.
I think your concerns are valid, Your Honor, but I believe that trial courts, first of all, you're not going to run into that problem until the actual lawsuit is filed. And number two, I think trial courts they have the power under Rule 166A to require confidentiality and put a Chinese wall between them.
No, I'm not talking about that Chinese wall. I'm talking about the fact that once they make allegations and pleadings, the other side of the underlying lawsuit is going to find out what those allegations are. And they're going to obviously want to know what those are, and that can aid the opposing party in the underlying litigation and formulating its trial plan.
I simply do not find that to be compelling, because the discovery rule has made this, the way that it has been formulated in SB versus RV and Chimes, everybody knows at this time what the problem is.
Even the other side in the underlying litigation?
They easily could, yes. Well, I mean, they would be most involved, it seemed to me.
Can we get back to the...
Absolutely.
My understanding is, in terms of the policy consideration, that once counsel is no longer representing the client, there's no reason to toll because there's no longer a conflict. But wasn't that the exact case in Hughes? And then again, why would we not have to overrule Hughes under your position?
I'm suggesting that either Hughes should be overruled or should be modified. But I want to get to fact number three because it's real important and it lends right into what you're saying. Fact number three is that by March 30 of 1992, after having received the statement from Mr. Undercoffer that I'm no longer going to be your attorney and stating I didn't know if I had anybody to represent, Mr. Vanasek is very clear that he instructs Mr. Undercoffer not to work on the case any further. This is more than 2 years before the lawsuit is filed. So what you basically would be saying is then that the Hughes tolling rule comes into existence even though the attorney-client relationship has been completely severed at this point.
Well, Mr. Angel, on that point, I'm not sure what you say Mr. Vanasek's complaint is. If Mr. Vanasek hired Undercoffer to represent him on a claim he had, now that claim could be resolved in 6 months, it could be resolved in 2 years, it could be resolved in 5 years, and he could have three or four different lawyers all working on it. If the claim ultimately gets resolved the way Mr. Undercoffer wanted it resolved, then what does he have left? That he spent too much money getting to that end?
Right.
Now, is that a malpractice claim for spending too much money to get to the result he wanted, or is that a breach of contract?
Yes, no, it's a malpractice claim under Heath versus Heron, because what your basic contention is, particularly in a settlement situation, is when the attorney's conduct has essentially reduced the settlement value of the case over what it would have been, then that is clearly a malpractice claim, and it's a very complicated formula for determining the difference.
So Mr. Vanasek is willing not to bring a claim for what he should have gotten in his lawsuit. He's willing to bring a claim only for the amount of money he spent with Mr.
Yes, and he is very vociferous in this record about that.
So if there is a successful outcome, so his complaint is not that he lost a valuable claim. His complaint is that simply his lawyer charged him too much money.
Your Honor, he has a number of claims. You understand that the lawsuit was ultimately settled 3 years down the road. And it's very difficult to understand what he got because back at the time the settlement occurred, some of the parties were in bankruptcy. So basically, I think what he's claiming is, in broad categories, is number one, I spent an awful lot of money and I got substandard representation. And number two, because of this substandard representation,
based
the settlement
on what
value...
What's the measure against the result he achieved or the measure that the lawyer down the street wouldn't have charged him as much money up to the point that he fired his lawyer?
Yeah, well, the measure would be the excess, number one, insofar as the fees are concerned, would be what I should have been charged for a proper representation or the amount of money that it took me to correct the malpractice. And then the second aspect of that would probably be the diminished settlement value of the case.
Mr. Hatchell, going back to, I think, what you've been trying to talk with us about, my understanding is that your view is that Hughes does not set up a bright-line rule, and given the key facts that you've given us, that what you're saying is if Hughes remains the law, then it needs to be determined on a case-by-case basis, depending on whether or not the underlying policies are fulfilled?
Hughes does set up a bright-line rule if the court holds that the technical fact that Mr. Undercoffer stayed on the pleadings and did not file, well, and filed a motion to withdraw, which was then granted about 1 year and 10 months, he would be within the rule. And what I wanted to do is to demonstrate to you why the three rules on the three underlying policy that underlie the tolling rule just don't fit this case.
Okay, before you do that, can we go back to a question that Justice O'Neill asked you? And that is, since your key fact is the fact that Mr. Vanasek told Mr. Undercoffer that he didn't want him to be his lawyer anymore in March of 1992. Obviously, we have a conflict among the Court of Appeals about the effect of Murphy and the question of whether representation continues or not on
That's
the
true.
Hughes requirement.
That's true.
How do you reconcile those two cases, since you are taking the position that the the discontinuation of the representation is a key fact.
I don't know that you can reconcile the conflict in the cases, to be honest with you. I mean, and you also, well, I mean, the conflict there and is real.
If you add that fact and you go back and look at Hughes, then Hughes would have been decided differently.
Yes.
Because the lawyer was no longer representing the client at
yes.
the earlier point.
Well, and he also withdrew because he was okay. going to become a witness. And this court has not had any difficulty with people being sued who would be witnesses.
Okay, so your position is that Hughes is a bright line rule, but that we should modify Hughes to take into account whether or not the representation has been continued, at what point in time it was discontinued?
If I were to modify Hughes, let me say that it is a bright line, it can be a bright line rule in this case if you buy into the fact that his technically remaining on the pleadings is what triggered the total.
I'm not sure. He had an order allowing him to withdraw, but his name continued to be on the pleadings.
Well, if he has an order allowing him to withdraw, then I would think there was termination. And that's pretty close to what I'm arguing today, because if you will...
Well, you mentioned at the outset that you wanted to do a new rule. Would you tell us what you think it should be since the red light's on, and we'd like to hear that before you sit down.
Absolutely. I would take two approaches. I would say that because the tolling rule is one that comes into effect only after accrual, in which everyone has discovered the malpractice, that it really has utility only in a very, very limited circumstances. It should be limited to situations where the malpractice is committed and discovered in the course of an ongoing trial, or malpractice is committed and discovered at a point in the representation where it is impossible that the litigation be delayed and new counsel employed. But the tolling should always stop any time malpractice is specifically charged and any time a new attorney.
Don't you run into the same problem with one of the policy issues that was raised in Hughes, and that is the fact that we now have a new attorney does not solve the dilemma of putting the client in the position of having to take positions inconsistent in the malpractice action with the positions being taken in the underlying litigation. That policy reason still exists even with a new attorney, doesn't it?
It would, but I believe the better approach, quite frankly, is to let that inconsistency be handled by abatement. And I'm not candidly so sure.
So that's the other part of your new rule.
Right.
You must file within 2 years of knowing that there was malpractice, but you move for abatement and wait till the other action.
Yes, Your Honor, that's right. But the ultimate position, because I'm really uncomfortable with the way that the tolling rule has to operate, and particularly when you see it in a case like this, that I really think that it should be abandoned for this reason. Intervening between the tolling, between Hughes and Mahaney and Murphy is SB versus RV and Childs versus Hosek. And I think that because of the heightened knowledge of both who has done the wrongdoing and the nature of the injury required in the discovery rule, you get considerable protection from the tweaking of the discovery rule. And if the court would just slightly tweak the legal injury rule so that it didn't operate as a hindsight test, I think that you would be there and you wouldn't need to.
What do you explain that about tweaking the legal injury rule?
Right. What has happened, Your Honor, is that, and in Hughes Mahaney is just a perfect example of this. The parties won in the trial court, who ultimately ended up, because what their lawyer did, it was not so clear that it was wrong, and it was only declared to be wrong and harmful by the Court of Appeals opinion. What I would say is, and the way I would have handled Hughes and Mahaney is, instead of taking the situation and saying, we find what you did was wrong, and we look back and say you sustained a legal injury when the document was signed in the trial court, I would say that no, the legal injury has only matured at the time of the Court of Appeals opinion.
So that we're really then abandoning a tolling rule and going back to basic principles of accrual.
Absolutely.
What great harm?
With discovery.
What great harm occurs by waiting until, by applying Hughes?
Your Honor, to me, a great deal of harm occurs. Number one, cases which begin at an administrative level, for example, and work their way through the court system can take nearly a decade sometimes to resolve, and that gets you right into the policy of limitations against stale claims.
So
the second thing that I find to be most troublesome about the tolling rule is that it assumes that the parties need to stay together to work it out. And I think that is demonstrated by this case, this relationship from the moment the trial, original trial, was terminated, became accurate, and it was not helpful to either party. And if third parties, if malpractice had been put on the table, the parties had been able to come to the table and say, we have a problem, how are we going to do this? The clock is running, we've got to do something about this, and perhaps get another lawyer, perhaps get mediators, but at least get it on the table. I think that the attorney-client relationship would have been greatly benefited in this case, rather than encouraging people who are at one another's throats to stay together and work it out.
I don't understand why both of those can't be accomplished, because one, under your proposal, they would have to file the abate, and so the length of time of the second lawsuit is still going to be there. And two, I don't understand why we couldn't do it such that the party could go out and hire a new lawyer, but wait until that proceeding is completed before having to file a lawsuit against the old lawyer, and it still accomplishes your second situation. So I don't understand why we can't, within the confines of the current construct, still achieve the ends that you're trying to achieve.
Well, I think you still get there as a result of the legal injury rule and the discovery rule as it is applied. And the difficulty that the courts are having in applying the tolling rule as modified by Murphy, to me, is probably one of the best arguments as to why there are problems.
But wouldn't there be problems though applying the legal injury rule as you proposed it?
Well, I don't think so, but Your Honor, my experience in this area is that there are no neat set of facts that you can categorize.
But aren't they within buying into another set of troubles? I mean, that would be a legal determination, I suppose, not up to a jury.
I'm not so sure that's true, Your Honor. What research I have done in other states indicates that this is the more traditional approach, that the tolling rule is probably one of the least favored things. It emulates the so-called continuous representation rule, which itself has some quixotic aspects to it, because what if the attorney himself resigns in the middle of the litigation and or in the process? Then the continuous representation rule, and I would say that the tolling rule probably doesn't apply.
But how would your legal injury rule apply in this case?
Oh, well, the legal injury rule and the discovery rule are oftentimes simultaneous. And I would say this case is governed more by the discovery rule than it is the legal injury rule.
Well, but aren't they intertwined? I mean, you know, under your analysis.
They're both doctrines of accrual.
Yes. And so you'd have to find the legal injury before there'd be full accrual, correct?
Well, legal injury to me always is the first inquiry.
Well, and again, in this case, when would the legal injury have occurred under your definition?
Oh, according to Mr. Banasek himself, it occurred at the termination. It occurred at least at the termination of the first trial.
But the way you just defined how you'd apply it under Hughes, it wouldn't have occurred until the trial court ruled.
That's true, but there are different kinds. The problem that you have is that the various kinds of malpractice, again, cannot be put in neat legal categories. Here we have a basically performance problems. He didn't prepare. He didn't understand the documents. He didn't call witnesses. The problem in Hughes and Mahaney was a legal problem. What is the legal effect of the document?
Well, but why wouldn't that injury have occurred the minute that affidavit was signed, naming the wrong person? I would have a very difficult time under your legal injury.
I think you have a latent injury there. When you're talking about the legal effect of what I have done, it takes the intervention of the trial court and the Court of Appeals, and they won in the trial court. So you can't have this situation of, I've sustained a legal injury. The trial court rules, I didn't sustain a legal injury. The Court of Appeals rules, I did sustain a legal injury. It seems to me that you get to determine when there's a legal injury, when the appellate process or the trial court's been in the terrorist.
So there would be some cases in which you really would have to wait until the appellate process was concluded before there was a legal injury, but in other cases it might not be the case.
Yes.
As in your view, in all tort actions, since the threshold question is when the legal injury occurred, it's not the same in every tort case, and the same would be the case in a legal malpractice.
Precisely. Your Honor did a much better job than I did.
I just want to make sure I understood.
One more question, Mr. Hatchell. Is your argument the same about Hughes' limitations with regard to the DTPA claim?
Your Honor, on the DTPA, what we think there is very simple. The legislature has incorporated into it the discovery rule, and we believe that the legislature's policy is that that is the way in which the attempt to balance what's fair between attorney and client has been handled, and that the courts simply should not engraft a common law exception onto that.
Sure. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Bonner.
May it please the court, Mr. Robert Leiber, the present argument for the respondent.
It pleases the court. Getting back to, I think I can address this from an attorney who actually looked at Hughes back in 1994 whenever this case came to me. As far as the bright line in 1994 when I reviewed this case and reviewed Hughes, Hughes stood and I believe still stands for the proposition that there is a bright line. That when the negligence occurs in litigation, ongoing litigation, that the statute is limitations is told until that litigation is concluded by a final judgment.
It seems to me your client's claims fall into two categories. And one category has to do with basically billing issues, that your client was overcharged or that the charges weren't reasonable. And the other category of damages or claims has to do with it affected the underlying litigation. Shouldn't we make an effort to parse those out?
Well, if truly I have contract and tort claims in one and the same in this case, then were they separated out, the contract claims might well be covered by a longer statute of limitations than were the negligence claims.
But that billing issue isn't necessarily a contract issue, though, is it, if in fact the allegation is that the litigation was mishandled and the result was that excessive fees were generated in prosecuting the suit on the note. So that would also be a negligence claim.
That would be a negligence claim, Your Honor, if you were to divide it into two and have a separate one, but I don't think you can.
Well, following up on the issue Justice Owen raised, if in fact we have two kinds of claims alleged here, is it conceivable that one of them is not subject to the Hughes Bright Line rule?
Well, Your Honor, it is if it doesn't fit into the Hughes rule. It is if it's not, if the reasons for the Hughes rules and the reasons applying that, it might well be that both of those would fit into the Hughes rule. The same problems or underlying basis arise that prevent a client from going for, or that affect a client in asserting the claims against an attorney. In this case, Your Honor, and I think it's clear from the record before you, Mr. Vanasek is a fairly sophisticated individual. This dealt with a multi-million-dollar investment. I think there are few individuals that would have been able to go forward with asserting his difficulties with representation during the representation.
Let me ask you a question. He sued on a note, and did he claim for attorney's fees?
Your Honor, he sued on a note and did claim for attorney's fees. However,
now, if he made a claim for attorney's fees, would the other side raise a defense over what he claimed for attorney's fees by noting an abated lawsuit or on the other side where he's arguing that the fees were not reasonable and necessary?
Oh, certainly they could, Your Honor.
I mean, even if it was a contract claim for charging more fees than you otherwise thought you were supposed to be charged for services, there's a potential that he'd be coming and going. He's arguing that he ought to get his attorney's fees back, but the other side would say, well, wait a minute, you've already admitted that they're not reasonable because you sued your other lawyer over here claiming your fees weren't.
That's correct. In the underlying case, he's charged with having to prove their reasonable and necessary fees to collect them under applicable law, where if he had an abated lawsuit filed, he would have to be making exactly opposite allegation, and that allegation would be that they weren't reasonable and they weren't necessary in that suit, and that therefore he should be able to recover them back from the law firm.
Now, I interrupted you, and you started to say there was a claim for attorney's fees, but...
Well, there was a claim for attorney's fees, but there was no designation of expert.
to testify as to the attorney's fees. One of our grounds in our malpractice case was just that, that the discovery questions regarding experts did not list an attorney expert. And because, and I think if you look at the trial court record, because of that, the firm was unable to represent, and my clients are unable to testify in my client's case in chief as to attorney's fees.
Mr. Lyra,
yes.
Mr. Hatchell tried to explain why we should modify Hughes. How do you respond to his reasonings for the modification?
Your Honor, I have read Murphy, and reading that as a modification as to why it should be modified, if you want a rule that's understandable, and a rule, and I think the court's touched on this, that does not require the attorney to address whether or not the underlying policy issues are present, but instead whether the underlying facts are present, then his modification of Hughes would lead right back to the problems that had been there before in trying to apply the discovery rule or trying to apply the legal injury rule. I think if you're to back off from the Hughes holding and to apply different requirements that the tolling be based on the existence or non-existence of the policy factors, for example, whether or not the client would be required to take that inconsistent position and whether or not the client would be required to hire another attorney, then all of a sudden, instead of a rule applying to limitations that could easily be applied upon the facts, you would be weighing the existence of these policy requirements.
Do you agree with Mr. Hatchell that the legal injury may occur at different points in time in the litigation process depending on the kind of malpractice that was committed and the specific facts, underlying facts?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you agree that the legal injury in a legal malpractice case involving services provided in the context of litigation does not always occur at the point in time the appellate process is exhausted, but may in fact occur at an earlier point in time?
There might be the perfect example in this case, Your Honor, because of the recess of the trial to go out and to mediate this case again, two of the defendants filed a bankruptcy, Chapter 7 bankruptcy actions. Certainly, their actions in going forward and using that interim time period to file that Chapter 7 bankruptcy action, any injury to my client caused by if the trial had gone through, he'd gotten his judgment, had an opportunity to collect it before that, if there is injury caused by the delay he didn't agree to, and them filing bankruptcies, that's certainly correct. That injury would probably occur when the discharge was granted in the accompanying bankruptcy. And certainly under that set of facts, there would be the legal injury as to those two parties certainly occurred before the appellate court would have finished, or in this case, before final judgment was entered.
Well, why then would you respond to Mr. Hatchell's argument that application of the legal injury rule coupled with the discovery rule would further the policies that were announced in Hughes better than using a tolling rule?
Well, okay, let's talk about first the discovery rule. And let's apply the facts of this case where my client was very unhappy with representation soon after the trial concluded. Let's say that you apply the discovery rule for that. You still have a time period of almost 1 year after that in which the attorney continued to represent my client. If in applying that discovery rule to make him move forward on that case certainly brings up the problem of moving forward to file another case that will cause him to reveal the problems with this underlying case. I think the perfect example in this case is, if my client's required to move forward, one of our allegations is that the attorney failed to prove up the elements of the note case.
But let me take you back. In the facts in the Hughes case, the trial court ruled in favor of the client who ultimately sued the attorney for malpractice. It was the Court of Appeals that reversed trial court's decision and made the signature or the identification of the attorney in the affidavit to become legally significant by ruling against the client. Do you agree that in that case there was no legal injury until the point in time the legal effect of that affidavit was finally resolved in the appellate court?
No.
You think there was a legal injury at an earlier point in time?
And here's the reason, okay. Your Honor.
if the court, in concluding that that affidavit had a problem under the laws that existed at the time the affidavit was done, even though you haven't had a final ruling from the appellate court that that affidavit was bad, it can be argued that the injury occurred then because the affidavit had been used.
But how, what injury? We don't have to have the complete injury, but we have to have some injury for there to be legal injury and for a cause of action to accrue. What injury is there to the client at that point in time? The document's been filed, it's on file with the court, but they still have the child. And in fact, they have a ruling from a trial court that says they are entitled to keep the child. What injury have they actually experienced at that point in time? I realize the event has occurred that ultimately causes the injury, but what injury have they experienced at that point in time?
Your Honor, at that time, and I agree with this court that it might well be hard to ever quantify what that injury was, at that time, their keeping the child has been jeopardized by the actions of that attorney. At that time, their injury is where they could be at the point of having an adoption that could not be challenged. They're at the point of, although they have the trial court judgment, that underlying judgment has a defect basically caused by that affidavit.
Your view is that the legal injury did accrue at the point in time the improper affidavit was filed with the trial court.
It could well do so, yes, Your Honor. And it's hard to say that, and especially when you start applying the discovery rule hand in hand with it, that to go back and say, well, if that affidavit was bad on the day it was filed, and that affidavit was not sufficient on the day it was filed, that anyone observing that and understanding the underlying law would know that it was bad, and therefore someone should have.
Well, but we've got two accrual rules working here. We have the basic legal injury rule and the possibility of the cause of action accruing when the injury was discovered, if in fact that's invoked. So those are two different issues. I'm concerned about just the basic legal injury rule, and it seems to me that legal injury in the context of attorney malpractice committed in litigation could occur at different points in time in the process based on the facts.
I agree with that statement, Your Honor. Yes, I do.
So if that's the case, why do we need a tolling rule?
Well,
why can't we use a legal injury rule to further the policies of Hughes and in those cases in which it takes ultimate resolution of the case in the appellate courts for the injury to have occurred?
But in fact, Hughes is at least partially based on a legal injury rule that says the injury hasn't occurred until all the appeals are over.
That's a tolling rule.
I'm sorry. The tolling, that applies a tolling rule, but underlying that tolling rule is just in the example you gave, even if the Court of Appeals had held that the affidavit was bad, the argument be made that the injury hasn't completed or occurred because there is one more appeal than that.
But a tolling rule works differently than the accrual work. In a tolling situation, you actually have a cause of action that's accrued, but we're going to toll limitations until an event occurs that would cause the tolling period to end. For example, if you have a minor injured in a situation, and we have a statute that says that minors are under disability, and so there's tolling. So they may be injured at the point in time, so their cause of action accrues, but it's tolled until such point in time as their disability is removed. And then the cause of action basically springs back up and the time starts running again. Isn't that what Hughes does? And when I'm asking you are questions about why you need that in the context of litigation, don't the principle, I'm giving you a chance to respond to Mr. Hatchell's argument,
okay.
So I'm playing devil's advocate here. Then doesn't the accrual rule take care of those considerations?
It doesn't, Your Honor,
okay.
In my opinion. And the reason the accrual rule, because of the termination of the occurrence of the injury, as I've just discussed, is not always that easy to do. In your example of, did the affidavit cause an injury? Was there an injury caused back there? Did the actions of the attorney, and let's take, for example, in the case before this court, the actions of the attorney in the trial, certainly from my client's viewpoint, were insufficient to adequately represent him. It is possible that could have been cured by another attorney later on. It is possible that many things could have happened later on that would have cured that. If you look at only the accrual rule, you place my client in the position of saying, well, I'm going to go hire another attorney. I'm going to try to fix the problem.
Aren't you obligated to mitigate the damages anyway?
You are, Your Honor. And you would put my client in a position of saying, well, I'm gonna go hire another attorney and I'm gonna hope there's some way he can go forward and fix this, which didn't occur in this case, as the trial had already begun. And the only thing that happened after that is the trial was completed. So as he goes forward with this other attorney, he's got to, if you use the legal injury rule, he's got to file a suit, either abate it or pursue it. I think it's an excellent point. I've had motions for abatement denied by trial courts even without new rules from any legislature.
But didn't we cross this bridge in Murphy where he said once the representation terminates, there's no longer this conflict to require a tolling provision as in Hughes, or would you just limit Murphy to accounting malpractice cases?
I've read Murphy many times. I'm not going to argue to this court that what was said in Murphy that I can say should be limited to accounting and not applied to the other, because obviously the ruling in that was not so narrow. And obviously the statements made in that did not pretend to distinguish like that. I would urge, though, that if Murphy and the courts of appeals have come down with just that. The courts of appeals have come down and said, basically, we read Murphy to modify Hughes, and that is that that the limitations period will not be told after the attorney withdraws. We fit into that rule. We're within the date of withdrawal. We actually filed suit within 2 years. So even if that is the rule, and even if Murphy were to apply, this case would not, the outcome in this case wouldn't be different. But the problem in trying to
should
go...
That, should we have a conflict in the Court of Appeals about whether or not Murphy modified Hughes so that continuation of representation is a requirement for the Hughes rule to apply? Should Hughes be modified so that in the event of a discontinuation of representation, the statute would begin to run at that point in time?
No. And the reason is, even though the attorney withdraws, the problem of the inconsistent position remains. The problem of having, and this is a perfect example, the attorney withdrew. The problem of taking inconsistent positions remains. The problem of going in and filing a suit, whether abated or pursued, that says my attorney failed to prove the elements of a note case in the case in chief, which has been completed in this case, and the injury it would cause him there. So the pure fact that the attorney withdrew in this case, even if you apply the other two matters mentioned in Murphy, there's strong policy reason that even after that attorney is gone, my client should not be forced into filing a lawsuit and doing discovery and other things in that lawsuit that may come back to haunt him in the underlying suit whenever it would require him to take an inconsistent position. I mean, it would be devastating my client to be faced in the trial court with a pleading of his own saying, oh, by the way, I've concluded my case in chief. In the trial court, the case was they stopped the trial to go mediate, but the plaintiff's case was concluded at that time. And other than rebuttal, the plaintiff would not have an opportunity to present other evidence. And it puts him in the dilemma of coming in and saying, oh, by the way, this, my case in chief, which I concluded without the opportunity to provide extra evidence for, is insufficient in that my attorney failed to prove up to all the elements of the note case. And that remains the problem, even if we were to say that Murphy expresses the law and that Hughes should be changed for that expression, that's a huge consideration as to how far you would go with it. Because if we were to say, make it a, if you have, you know, either one, if you retire, required to hire new counsel or required to take an inconsistent position that it wouldn't apply, that would certainly be better than having those in the conjunctive. But I think Hughes still stands for, and the application of the tolling is still called for, because of the problems in forcing the client to go forward with the claim against the attorney while the other case continues to be pending. It sort of gets me over into it. I started out with this. I read Hughes when I started this case. One of the grounds that I brought forward to this court is the retroactive application of Murphy. Murphy's a 1997 case. As a matter of fact, this case was already in the Court of Appeals in Dallas, I believe, at the time that happened. On the day this case was filed, Hughes stood, and I think, as clearly in point with this case, and is clearly holding that limitations would not run until the judgment, a final judgment, was rendered in the underlying case. I don't pretend to be able to read Hughes in 1994 and to look at it and say, oh, I anticipate troubles down the road, or I think one of these underlying policy considerations may be applied as a prerequisite, so I better get going on that. And I wish I could, but I can't. But I will urge this court, especially in Hugh Vanasek's case, that on the day this case was filed, and filed relying on the tolling of Hughes, that was clearly the law in this state. That limitations had clearly not run under Hughes on the day that this case was filed, and to come back now with basically the case in Murphy, that quite truthfully is long after the summary judgment had been granted in this case, would not fit the requirements for a retroactive application, which is basically what would be done. I mean, this, and I think to address on the DTPA, I disagree. I think the DTPA, the application of Hughes tolling is to the DTPA just as it would be to the underlying.
And why do you believe that?
Well, I don't think that the legislature was in grafting the discovery rule or into the DTPA statute of limitations meant that it was exclusive. And I think the perfect example is, to go one step further with that, if that was meant to be exclusive, then there would be no tolling, for example, for a minor, if you were to say the same thing. That the tolling for a minor until they reach the age of 18, although statutory, is not included in that rule.
Well, but can't they do that if they want to?
The legislature certainly can do. I mean, no doubt about it. The legislature could have provided that this is the exclusive. No other tolling.
They don't have to say that. They either put it in or out, and you've got a statutory scheme that says the discovery rule applies, and that's what you're supposed to do in the deal.
Basically, the case in Murphy, that quite truthfully, as long after the summary judgment had been granted in this case, would not fit the requirements for a retroactive application, which is basically what would be done. I mean, I think to address on the DTPA, I disagree. I think the DTPA, the application of Hughes tolling is to the DTPA just as it would be to the underlying.
And why do you believe that?
Well, I don't think that the legislature was in grafting the discovery rule or into the DTPA statute of limitations meant that it was exclusive. And I think the perfect example is, to go one step further with that, if that was meant to be exclusive, then there would be no tolling, for example, for a minor, if you were to say the same thing. That the tolling for a minor until they reach the age of 18, although statutory, is not included in that rule.
Well, but can't they do that if they want to?
The legislature certainly can do. I mean, no doubt about it. The legislature could have provided that this is the exclusive. No other tolling.
They don't have to say that. They either put it in or out, and you've got a statutory scheme that says the discovery rule applies, and that's what you're supposed to do in the DTPA action, rather than go outside and look at some other theory.
But you still, even in that, Your Honor, you have to go outside and look at the tolling limitations, tolling statutes, for example, regarding minors or other things, that because that rule is not...
law that says that applies in the DTPA case?
What's that, Your Honor?
That the minor tolling provision applies in a DTPA case in the face of a discovery rule statutory requirement.
I think it would, Your Honor.
No, do we have any law that says
Do we have any law? Your Honor, quite truthfully, I have not reviewed extensively that part of the deal. I think I cite some cases that would hold that the application of these tolling rules is a judicial function, and that... I know I have some cases cited to that authority. I do not believe I have a case cited to the specific authority you asked about.
Mr. Lockhart, one more question. Are you presently, given the current Texas law, are there any other common law tolling rules besides the Hughes rule that you're aware of? I mean, the legislature's codified...
Right.
Everything else that used to be the common law, at least, and I'm not sure the answer, and I'm asking you, are there any other common law tolling rules that are part of our jurisprudence right now?
I'm not sure of that answer either, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you,
Counsel. Thank you.
Mr. Hatchell, are you aware of any other common law tolling rules?
Continuous representation rule operates as that, and there is a common law slash rule which says that an attorney has an obligation to notify when malpractice occurs, and then they deem sort of an abatement. You know, that's not a particularly satisfactory one. Those are the only two that I know of. And, Your Honor, there is a law review article cited in our briefing, which really is an excellent review nationwide of these problems.
But outside the legal malpractice area, too, under Texas law, are you aware of any other common law
tolling
rules?
No, not any tolling rules.
Okay, thank you.
I want to ask you about your legal injury rule. And let's look at Hughes, but let's take a little bit different factual scenario. Let's suppose in the case in Hughes, the trial court had ruled against the client. And at that point, the client knows that the affidavit was bad and sues the lawyer, but in the meantime appeals. And the court of appeals reverses and says, no, the affidavit was good. So we no longer have a legal injury. And under your theory of the case, we would have generated a whole second lawsuit for naught in cost and all of that.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think where I part company with this is a whole lawsuit for naught.
Well, where is the legal injury? When the trial court says, yes, it's a bad affidavit, but ultimately the court of appeals said, no, it's a good affidavit. Where does the legal injury occur in that continuum?
The expenses that I have to incur to remedy the problem. And I find, quite frankly, in these cases that is always a major component.
Yeah, but we don't know what those expenses are until the court of appeals rules.
Yes, I suppose that's true. But again, you're not abating causes of action to wait till you know an exact dollar amount, as long as you know that effort has to be expended.
But what if you're suing on a breach of contract claim, and in fact you're able to recover with the new lawyer 100% of the attorney's fees spent by lawyer one and lawyer two, such that the verdict and ultimate appellate decision and with regard to the second lawyer covers all of the legal expenses and all of the costs. In that situation, you wouldn't have an injury.
You might not in that instance. That's correct.
Do you agree that under Murphy,
from mere filing, you talk about abatement, but if the issue is the attorney's fees you're attempting to collect in the underlying lawsuit, wouldn't it be some relevant information in that case that the parties had a separate lawsuit, although it's abated, but the allegations in that lawsuit is that those attorney's fees aren't reasonable? Isn't that inconsistent? Isn't the mere existence of a lawsuit, doesn't that pose an inconsistency problem in the underlying lawsuit?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because first of all, the pleadings can be drafted in a way in which you don't reveal confidential information, and if it gets to be such a point, I think the pleadings could probably be filed under seal, or at least portions of them could, although this is not something that I think I'm particularly worried about.
But it would be inconsistent, and it would, unless it was sealed or otherwise, be relevant to the underlying litigation.
I think so, but again, I think we can deal with these problems with the present rules that we have for managing the litigation. And you know, bear in mind, you have what I'm concerned about. Well, really, is not so much.
Let me explore that with you, Judge. I'm being sued for attorney's fees on this debt. I don't think those attorney's fees are reasonable or necessary, and the plaintiff has in fact sued his own lawyer because he claims those fees are unreasonable. And now he comes to you and objects to my being able to introduce that information in this trial because it ought to be sealed and that's a separate lawsuit and it ought to not interfere. It seems to me the trial judge would say, no, I think it's relevant here.
No, I think when you get to trial, it's
so
it
what
relevant.
What rule do you think can deal with that problem?
Well, I'm not so concerned about that as a problem. If you're talking about the actual trial of the case, and I would have had the opportunity to say, and I think you would be able to say this whether there was an underlying lawsuit or not, that these fees are excessive in relationship to the effort that's been expended. I think you have that anyway.
But you don't ordinarily have the plaintiff saying he agrees.
You again put the client into taking conflicting positions. In the case where the client's suing its own lawyer, the client would be saying the fees were excessive, but in the case where the client's trying to win, the client would be saying the fees are reasonable.
But the other side can always challenge the reasonableness of them, and is it ethical?
But they wouldn't be relying upon the evidence generated by forcing the client to have to sue its own lawyer.
I would really question the ethics of contending that all of my fees were reasonable when in truth and in fact I believe they were not. I mean, we do have frivolous pleading rules. So I'm not so concerned about that thing insofar as the impact upon the broader system.
Going back to an accrual type of analysis would help get the cards on the table. It really leaves a lot of the same uncertainties about when limitations runs that the tolling runs. Would you agree with that?
Your Honor, my experience in these areas is that there are always going to be uncertainties, and there's not going to be a rule that's going to solve every problem. Every case poses a different one. And if I could just... You know, this case in particular is one that I think is almost a law school examination, because if you thought you were doing a bright line test in Hughes and Mahaney, but look what happened. Were there inconsistent positions? Was Mr. Vanasek forced to inconsistent positions? No, because he'd already, more than 2 years, accused his lawyer of extreme negligence and stated in writing he was not capable of handling the case. Was he forced to obtain new counsel? No. The second trial didn't commence for 3 years. Mr. Underkoffler is reported to have said, "I am no longer going to be your attorney." And Mr. Vanasek had put in writing more than 2 years before the malpractice suit in stating that he was not capable of working with him and instructing him to cease.
That was going to be my question. Under Murphy, if we apply that exception when counsel is no longer involved in the case, then technically, if you measure that from the date of the order of withdrawal, they're within the limitations period.
Absolutely.
But you would make that area murky as well by determining when, in fact, they really weren't lawyer-client anymore rather than formally. And doesn't that, again, create another set of problems?
Well, again, what I'm trying to do is to test the policy values that underlie it and say, does it always work? And is it worth it to have the tolling rule when the only thing that it does is it carries the limitations period along for the technical reason that somebody is still on the pleadings when every policy value that underlies the case has been destroyed.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.